Welcome to another episode of the Telltale Heart, Pharmacy Times Cardiovascular Digest for Pharmacists. I'm your host, as always, Craig Beavers. And today we're going to do something a little different than our last episodes. I think if you heard our last episode, you're quite aware that in the next few weeks, or at the end of this month of August, the European Society of Cardiology meeting will be coming up. And we're going to spend the next few episodes prepping for the meeting, and this is one of those episodes, and then after the meeting, doing a lot of in-depth coverage. And so in order to maybe spare some guests and make sure that we don't burn everybody out, I'm kind of going to do a solo episode, and this is a little bit different because there's not going to be a guest, so may not be as exciting or dynamic, but it's definitely going to be me, and hopefully I won't make it feel like I'm just droning on, but I do want to again, highlight or bring up some other studies and things that are interested for the meeting or of interest for the meeting, excuse me. And also really bring out some things that people have said on social media about things that they're excited about. And also want to highlight a statement that's coming out that is also interesting and germane and also has a little personal bias with me. So we'll jump right in the episode. I do want to take some time to also today to really, A, first and foremost, thank you for listening and being engaged. I appreciate all the feedback and the awareness that people have either provided or provided commentary or the circulation or the views. I do want to encourage, please, please, please to continue to like, subscribe, rate us, give us a 5. If you don't feel like giving us 5, that's fine. Give us some feedback. We want to make sure we understand how we can make this better. It's almost like an art form. It's an evolutionary process. You're creating something new. You're trying to tailor it. And I know it feels like we haven't played with the formula. We have a little bit. If you noticed the last episode, we had several guests kind of like in a panel-like format. I have some ideas that I would like to try in the future that are maybe a little bit more kind of, I don't want to say comical, but balanced. I'm still working to find some patients to get their perspective. But again, we really want to hear from you and how this is meaningful. And maybe it is meaningful just to hear what people are doing and hear evidence, but then putting that evidence together in practice. So, the only way we know how to do this and to make it better is for you to let us, have feedback, send us emails, drop it in. Who are you sharing with this? I would love to know that type of information as well. And hopefully you find a value. And if not, we want to make it of value. And again, the only way to do that is if you like or subscribe or drop us an email or let me know. Or if you see me at a meeting or somewhere, just be like, I love your podcast. Or, here's what you could do differently or what we would like to see. I'm very open to creative and constructive feedback as long as you make it constructive. I'm not one of those people who, if you don't like it, that's fine. Everyone has their opinion. But tell me why. Just saying you don't like something is not very constructive. Okay, now that we got that out of the way, before we jump into the ESC coverage, I want to make everyone aware of about an article that is dropping this August 12th, the same day that this episode will be dropping. And it is a very nice scientific statement from the Heart Failure Society of America in combination with the American Society for the Prevention of Cardiology. It's a joint statement on the shift for heart failure prevention and care. And I think we've talked a little bit about this within the domain of cardio-kidney metabolic, but I think it's important to be aware that, heart failure obviously is affecting 6 million Americans, and it's projected to reach over 11 million by 2050. And we do have lots of therapies, but we still know that there's lots of readmissions and lots of increased mortality. And some of the challenges that come with heart failure is if we could have maybe prevented or delayed the progression of it or other disease states, that we might have had a better opportunity to manage. And I think this is going to be really interesting to try to do, because if you really look at advanced heart failure programs in terms of some of the training and spots, they've had a real struggle filling physicians into those programs or physicians going into those subspecialties at this time. And you know, I think it's really important to try to minimize or prevent the impact that we can and reduce our economic burden. So this is the first time that there's a joint scientific statement from the Heart Failure Society of America and the American Society of Preventive Cardiology. And I had the privilege of being on the author group. So I'm a little biased towards this publication, but I think it's important. And this is going to be jointly published in the Journal of Cardiac Failure and the American Journal of Preventive Cardiology. And it's the Continuum of Prevention and Heart Failure and Cardiovascular Medicine. And it provides an integrative framework of preventive strategies across all stages for heart failure, regardless of ejection fraction, from risk identification in healthy individuals to secondary prevention in those with established disease, all the way to tertiary strategies in patients with advanced therapy such as LVADs or heart transplants. And it goes across the spectrum of looking not just at, oh, what do we need to do for medications in this stage? It talks about lifestyle changes. What do those need to look as we progress through the various stages? It looks at things even in domains like cardio-oncology as patients are being treated for a different illness, and we know that they have risk of cardiovascular disease. And it's not an in-depth overview, but it's a framework and really paints a nice picture of how these things are all becoming interlocked and interplayed, and how we need to decrease some silentization. And my important message to pharmacists is there definitely is a lot that pharmacists can play into this statement. Again, obviously, clearly the medication things are the most obvious in thinking about where you're interacting with your patient. But if I think about a pharmacist across the spectrum of where they practice, looking in the community, either in the health system, in the hospital, outpatient, you know, managed care, there really is an opportunity for us to be engaged in prevention of heart failure. And that can come in a variety of different domains. That can become through the domains of developing population health programs, where we're really trying to screen and identify risk. And I think we've talked a little bit about this before, looking at, you know, UACR screening in patients who are diabetic and heart failure, or even that have risk factors like hypertension that we need to look at to maybe prevent the progression of kidney disease, which can impact heart failure therapy. We also know that there are a lot of patients who have risk factors on that CKM continuum, like obesity and metabolic disorder, that can lead to this sequela of heart failure or atherosclerotic disease. And so we need to be able to really engage and think beyond just treating, but what is the things that we have in this day and age in our toolbox for prevention. And it's a good conversation to have, as I think, you know, a lot of times when I'm in heart failure clinic, we're also looking at these other things, or making sure that we're not just focusing on the heart failure, but like, oh, have they had their lipids checked in a while? Or have we missed an opportunity to, you know, manage them from having other issues or comorbidities that are related to this? And, you know, of course, there's a lot of good strategies throughout this that we think also from a preventive standpoint, like hypertension control or blood pressure control. And this is going to be kind of the beginning of the renaissance of hypertension management. I know we've had new things like renal denervation come out that could maybe help with polypharmacy, but this year, in the next several months, the new hypertension guidelines are going to come out. And then we have a slew of other therapies that are underway that are being developed for hypertension management. So it really does provide an opportunity that maybe we can better evaluate patients. And we talked a little bit about those studies last week that are going to be presented at ESC. If you remember correctly, or want to go back and listen to that episode. You know, of course, glucose management and weight loss, we've talked some about those, but even getting into the process of genetic risk screening and looking for, you know, people that may have those genetic markers that predispose them to, you know, some form of cardiomyopathy. And so this is a first national roadmap to really link preventive cardiology with heart failure management. And it really does emphasize a collaborative, multidisciplinary model. And so, you know, the key highlights of this are expanded focus on risk factors, both traditional, such as the hypertension, diabetes, and including sex-specific differences, like hypertensive disorders of pregnancy and premature menopause. And we often think, oh, we need to think about women and cardiovascular disease or women's heart disease. And sometimes I've had this conversation actually pretty recently. People say that, and they say, oh, yes, we need to do better for female patients. But then the actual implementation and practice isn't always there. And then thinking about genetic, environmental, and social determinants of health, I think that will continually be an important piece or process. to manage these patients. And then again, this is looking at a lifespan-based prevention framework. So it talks about across all stages, even as you think about younger patients who may not have elevated risk, and then using innovative tools like biomarkers, polygenic risk scores, and AI-based models to improve early detection and risk stratification. And obviously, AI is going to become a profound tool in healthcare and identification. And of course, most importantly, team-based care is important. And then thinking about it holistically and not just thinking about, oh, pharmacotherapy, other things, but nutrition, cardiac rehab. Not enough people go to cardiac rehab, especially our heart failure patient population. And then psychological health is real important. We talk about that. You know, the amount of patients that have some form of mental health issue or disorder, or whether it be independent of the disease state or caused by the disease state, and really connecting those dots. And if you think about those domains and how they improve or can impact adherence, you talk about optimism has a construct to prevention and management, and then just overall depression and screening. So it really is a strong statement, and I would encourage you to spend some time with it, kind of think about it, and think where you can put that in the framework of your day or how you're going to be proactive about it. And I'd love to hear from you all what you think about it and what you would like to see or how you would go about doing it. I think it's very thought-provoking from that standpoint to put in that construct. All right. So with that being said, I'm going to transition to my US or ESC coverage. I do appreciate some folks who had reached out on the last podcast episode to, you know, kind of tell us about what they're excited about with ESC or what they're hoping for. You know, I think Bill Baker, who we've had a guest before, responded, shout out to Bill, on the Twitter feed or the X feed, and said he's interested in Victor, and hopefully he enjoyed our conversation with the team last week about what the Victor results are going to mean. I think a lot of people are going to be interested in the results and how to implement them. And then I also want to thank Jake Plunecki. He mentioned a variety of different things that we're going to maybe talk a little bit about them today, but he had a list. And so he brought, you know, the DAP shock AMI. And so what that trial, and we'll talk a little bit about that today, is looking at kangaroo lore, using, it in the management of acute myocardial infarction. Everybody wants to see the danger shock outcomes, long-term outcomes with the Appella device, especially if you are working in a unit and managing cardiogenic shock. The Odyssey and Maple HOCM studies, which we kind of briefly hinted and allude to. And of course, there is going to be a ton of data as usual around dual antiplatelet therapy. And we're going to talk a little bit about those today and why they're different than the previous studies. So one study I kind of alluded to last week, and just to give a different flavor for those of you that are into prevention and lipid management and lipidology. You know, we're going to have the Victorion Different Study, and this is a phase 4 randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial. It's a clinical trial to assess inclisiran's early efficacy, safety, and tolerability, as well as impact on quality of life in individuals with hypercholesterolemia. And so what this is they're going to look at patients 18 years of older, with hypercholesterolemia at very high or high risk of CV disease, despite being treated on individualized maximal tolerated statin dose. Participants are going to receive 1-to-1 either subcutaneous 300 milligrams of inclisiran or placebo, and then the treatment with inclisiran and placebo, they get open label rosuvastatin titrated up to goal, up to the maximally tolerated dose. And the objective is to assess LDL goals at 90 days, but then look at secondary things like muscle-related adverse events, pain, quality of life, and LDL reduction. So this is a little bit different than previous inclisiran studies because this is a upfront co-management strategy versus a staged late strategy, you know, where historically it's been a secondary line, and it's probably the first wave of looking at this, or it's going to be a part of a wave of looking at this. And so it'll be interesting to see, you know, if we get things going earlier and see that reduction clearly, we know if we improve LDL. And I think really what LDL is moving towards in a construct, and you'll probably hear people think about this, is not just what is the LDL exposure at the time that you manage it or if they have a disease, but what is their lifetime exposure of elevated LDL? And do we really need to be looking at patients earlier in their disease state or checking LDLs earlier and assuring that they're not moving up over time? However, this will be the first study that also includes this whole safety component and looking up front. So it has the potential to change or think about how we stage or manage therapy for patients over time. And obviously, you know, we know how inclisiran is dosed, you know, twice a year after the initial doses. So it'll be interesting to see what this is going to look like in the future and see how this will continue to grow. I'm sure there'll be other studies that are going to help answer this question. And obviously, as you're aware, and we won't go into the full event, there's the Essence TEMI 73B study that is looking at kind of our new agents in the realm of managing hypertriglyceridemia. They are a couple different agents that are being looked at in the space. And, you know, Essence 3 is a phase 3 multi-center randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial to look at the safety and efficacy of olezarsen, an antisense oligonucleotide inhibitor of APOC3 production, and it's administered subcutaneously. And it's looking at those with moderate hypertriglyceridemia and atherosclerotic CVD. If you think along the domains of like patients we historically treated with fish oil, and it's not exactly one-to-one, but it gives you a framework. And it'll be good to see, this will be the first phase 3 trial of this, and where that's going to fall into the overall management of patients with this disease. And the good news, or what the good news is, we're already aware with that trial, with Essence, that it has met the top line results. And they did show a statistically significant reduction in triglycerides versus placebo at 80 milligrams in the 50 milligram dose. And it met its key endpoints, secondary endpoints, and a favorable safety and tolerability profile. We'll be interested to see the devil in the details for that particular study as it comes out from that standpoint. I think Jack had alluded to, he was interested in the Kangaroo study looking at DAPT in patients with acute shock or cardiogenic shock. In this study, you know, if you're aware of Kangaroo is a intravenous P2Y2 inhibitor. It has some advantages potentially. If you think about patients in shock, you know, if you're worried about the gut motility or that there's a proper perfusion to be able to get P2Y12s, but you know that they're going to need some form of intervention to help the patient. This is kind of the first study that is looking at patients who are going to get randomized to, in a double-blind placebo-controlled fashion, to test intravenous Kangaroo is more effective in terms of its rate of onset and proportion of patients receiving or effectively achieving an ADP induced platelet aggregation, and is least as effective as crushed oral ticagrelor, which is its cousin, if you think about it in terms of agents, in reducing major adverse cardiac events in patients with cardiogenic shock getting primary PCI. And obviously, if you look at the inclusion criteria, it's a very high-risk shock patient population, traditionally patients that you would think in the danger shock group. And then we're going to look and see what their outcomes are. And so that'll be very exciting to hear. And so shout out to Jack for pointing that out and commenting and saying he's excited about it, given that it very much impacts his practice on a day-to-day. And I think the other things that he had alluded to is there are a variety of studies that are looking at early discontinuation of aspirin. We have one that's talking about within the first 30 days, target first of stopping aspirin after PCI in acute MI patients. And then there's another one, Neo Mindset. And interestingly, in this one, they are also looking at interventional patients with acute coronary syndrome, but they're stopping it pretty much at the end of this, as soon as they're randomized or discharged. So kind of earlier in the process, potentially. And what's interesting about these studies is, unlike our other DAP studies in early cessation of aspirin therapy or moving to single antiplatelet therapy, these are higher risk patients, or include a lot more higher risk patients, and really looking at that ACS population. So we've had all this data that suggests that it's helpful to do this, especially given the new wave of biodegradable stents or second generation, third generation stents, and obviously better stenting practices. IVUS and OCT, if you paid attention in the ACS guidelines, and I know pharmacists don't always think about the intravascular imaging, but it's an important call out because it's a class one recommendation to do those things. We are better at being able to deploy our stents more effectively. We have better stenting. And so really, it allows us, if you do those things, to think about a less aggressive dual antiplatelet strategy. And these studies, the NEO Mindset and the Target First, are going to be the first studies to really in-depth look at those questions for patients with acute coronary syndrome. So it'll be very exciting to see that piece. And then kind of the other one that I want to call out, and there's a lot. I will tell you, there's so much stuff we're going to have to talk about after this meeting to work through, is the ALONE AF study. And this is talking about discontinuing long-term anticoagulation after successful ablation. I know everybody's always trying to figure out or understand what the best strategy is. If we can stop anticoagulant after a patient has been successfully ablated, and as we get better ablation techniques with pulse field ablation and being able to more completely ablate the patient, what do patients need long-term anticoagulation? Of course, this landscape has changed a little bit, given that the use of left atrial appendage devices have really changed some of that domain. And we'll have the CHAMPION trial later this year that's looking at DOAC versus left atrial appendage, specifically those populations. We had the OPTION trial last year that looked at patients who were getting an ablation, so kind of like this population from that standpoint. And obviously, we have the factor 11A inhibitors that are going to be coming out the line. But it's an important question, because if we can, you know, change the trajectory of the patient or eliminate therapy and that risk, you know, it's an important conversation to have. You know, the other studies that we're looking out for, and one of them is the publication of the Odyssey HCM trial. And this is patients with non-obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And we already know that in this study that mavacamten did not meet its dual primary endpoints in this study in terms of KCCQ or Kansas City cardiomyopathy questionnaire and peak VO2 consumption compared to placebo at the 40-week follow-up. So it'll be interesting, you know, it was disappointing results, but it'll be interesting to see what the specific details of this is and why it might not have worked. And so we'll be looking to that as it gets published. And then on a different front, avacamten will be presented in the MAPLE study. And I think Jack also mentioned this study. And this is a different kind of group, but we all know also with this study that they were able to have positive top line results. And again, we need to look at the details of the study, but in the MAPLE study, it's a phase 3 trial comparing avacamten as monotherapy to standard of care beta blocker metoprolol in patients with obstructive symptomatic HOCM. If you think about the original trial that we have mavacamten for, and so it did meet its improvement in peak VO2 and so forth. So what we're kind of seeing is maybe this divergent, and want to understand the difference between obstructive and non-obstructive in terms of outcomes and what we can do differently. And so it'll be interesting to have conversations and contextualize those. So those are some other highlights from the meeting. If you are interested in being a guest or talking about these or have a passion about them, please let me know. We'll screen you and maybe bring you on and talk about all things ESC. That's going to be the next several months as we gear up. And then right after that, I'll be AHA. So I think that's going to be the next several months of topics. Again, thank you for listening. This will be more content to get us ready for the meeting. If you, again, like what you're hearing or want to hear other things, please let me know. let us know what you're doing and how we can engage you, or if you share this with your patients. So hopefully this was a good overview, a little bit different. You just get to spend a time with me and listen to that. You know, I guess normally we forgot to do this last week with our other guests, so we'll have to do it when they come back, you know, talking about what books or TV shows or movies or things that we're watching or reading. You know, I have recently gotten back from seeing AJR in concert. They're a great, great group. My kids and I enjoy the time with that group and have enjoyed their music a lot. They're fun. They have a positive message for the most part in a lot of their songs. So it's kind of what I've been listening to recently. And then the other book I've been listening to or reading and listening to is Jefferson Fisher's The Next Conversation. It's a great book. I think anybody should read it. I'm always a big proponent of trying to improve how I communicate with people or how I think about my communication. And it's a good kind of a no-brains book about how to handle various conversations and work through it. I would love to, if I had my way, to meet him and get to talk to him on the podcast. If anybody knows him, let me know. So that with that said, I appreciate your likes, your listens, and we look forward to bringing you the next episode. I think when we get to the next episode, it will literally be the tension will be mounting because it will be right the Tuesday before ESC. And so we'll be gearing up for that coverage. And so more to come. I hope you all have a great next couple of weeks. Thank you.